I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
It's the My First Gig podcast. Whoa, sharing stories of first gigs and shows. Comedians sharing their memories. The fun and entertaining, exciting and crazy. With Dwayne Dugan as your host. It's the My First Gig podcast. Here we go.
Hello and welcome to the My First Gig podcast. My name is Dwayne Dugan. Come on in, sit down, wash your hands first, eh? This is probably the safest public gathering that we can have in these scary times. Let's all sit down, gather around, listen to the My First Gig podcast, and you don't actually have to come into contact with anybody at all. If you're listening to this in the future, which most of you technically are, but if you're listening to us after March 2020, then we are currently in the middle of what I can only describe as a horror movie, where this virus is just sweeping the world and basically killing everybody. And we're just kind of waiting, going, ha ha ha, wash your hands. Isn't it so funny that we have to wash our hands? Remember when we didn't have to wash our hands? Everything's so funny. We're all going to die very soon. I shouldn't have to describe what it is. If you're listening to this after March 2020 and you don't know what the coronavirus was, then you are probably like a new person, a baby. Turn off the podcast. It's definitely irrelevant. Even though this was recorded like 2 years ago, it's irrelevant. Go away. Guys, thank you for coming back. I missed last week. The reason that all these podcasts are like really, really old is because I was afraid of not having enough and then missing a week. And I lasted 8 weeks before I missed a week, even though there's like 30 more recorded. Moved house, my stuff was in boxes. That's a lie. The stuff I needed, I knew exactly where it was. I just kind of ran out of time. Moved house on the Friday, went down visiting friends on the Saturday. That basically didn't end till the Tuesday. Then I got home and I had a big show on the Tuesday with a bit of prep beforehand, and all of a sudden it was Wednesday and I was just like, oh, this is late. And then by the time that it was going to get out, it was going to be Thursday. So I thought, let's not put it out on Thursday, keep it Wednesday, just push it back a week. And now here I am, 4:30 on the Tuesday, and I'm only doing this now. It's like, I could have done this a week ago. Even with 2 weeks prep, still leave it to the last minute. But thank you for coming back. Hopefully you didn't miss me too much last week. If you did, hopefully you went back and listened to some old episodes. Before I talk about Kerry Pritchard McLean, the Sean Walsh episode. So yeah, I was worried about the Sean Walsh episode. I probably would have put out earlier because I really did enjoy the chat. He's a great podcast guest, particularly when I put mine out. He'd been on the load in the recent weeks. He's just a fun, energetic, like, you hear him laugh at things. Like, he's laughing at things and you're like, what are you laughing at? But like, when you're listening, you're going, oh, this is great. This is so much fun to listen to. But I didn't put it out early because I was worried about the noise in the background. And thankfully, nobody complained about the noise in the background, which is nice. Yeah, I think the chat and the bloody superb editing made it just easy to listen to, and it was a fun chat. I particularly loved his story about crying in front of Comedia before what was technically meant to be his first gig. So yeah, if you haven't listened, go back and listen to myfirstgigpod.com. Sean Walsh in the archives, along with James Acaster, Ardla Hanlon, Catherine Bohart, Reg D. Hunter, loads of people. I've forgotten already. It feels like I've not done this in years. Right, okay. Kerry Pritchard McLean is one of the Cat Laughs 2018 recordings. There's more of them. I know there's only been 9 episodes so far, and yet you're going, was every one of these recorded at the Cat Laughs? Yes, every single one of these was recorded at the Cat Laughs. I recorded 412 episodes at the Cat Laughs. I recorded 3 elsewhere, and this is one of them. There's a few more coming. Kerry was great. I was living in London at the time, or was I? Or they just moved home? I don't know. I had recently been living in London, if I didn't at the time, and had seen her at shows around the place and just really, really enjoyed her. So it was great to sit down. If you haven't seen her live, you might have seen her on the telly. Would I Lie to You? Have I Got News for You? Roast Battle? 8 of 10 Cats Does Countdown? Comedy Central? Etc, etc, etc. She's the co-host of our very own podcast, All Killer No Filler. They were recently here in Dublin. I'm not sure if they did a full tour. Maybe they did. Maybe you saw them recently. Maybe that's why you're listening. Maybe you're listening because you just listened to our podcast and you're a fan of hers. If you are, hello, I'm Dwayne. Nice to meet you. Don't shake my hand. But it's a fun chat. But yeah, as I was saying, missed last week because we were moving house. Like, my God, we complained for ages about the size of the room that we lived in, me and my girlfriend, and that, like, it'd be so nice to have room for stuff. What we found out is that we are clearly the best packers of furniture and possessions in the world, because in our tiny little room we seem to have enough possessions to fill an entire house, like so much stuff. And you're met when you're moving house, if you've done it you'll know yourself, you throw out so much and you think, right, I've thrown out like 16 bin bags of things, I should have nothing left. And you've got boxes and boxes and suitcases and suitcases, and you're like, oh, you find things that you haven't seen in ages. You're like, oh great. It's like, well look, I haven't seen this t-shirt in 2 years. I clearly forgotten that I'd even had it. Do I really need this t-shirt? And you just look at it going, oh no, of course I really want that t-shirt. I'm a big fan of Franz Ferdinand. And like, you've never even seen Franz Ferdinand. You bought it in HMV about 15 years ago. And only now does it fit you, because for some reason clothes were just massive back in the day. Just throw it out. Get rid of it. Like, that's my advice. Go away and just throw things out this week. Now, I didn't do any of this. There's still boxes. We haven't even finished unpacking yet. There's still boxes everywhere. But just clear out. You don't need things. One thing I did get rid of, actually, was like toiletries. That, do you know the toiletries that you get for Christmas? The box sets of like body wash, face wash, arm wash, foot wash. Got rid of all of them. They're just these generic brands. Like one of the brands, I hope my mother doesn't listen to this. My mother bought me a box set and it was just called Man Stuff. And it was like, beard scrub, beard tonic, beard wash. Now, if you are listening, Mum, there is the beard little tonic things, little spray bottles. I use those. They're great. You bought me about 6 of those. Use them. They're deadly. But there was like the face wash and the face scrub. And there was one thing called man soap. It was a block of soap. And I'm just, if it's called man soap, I don't trust it. No, thank you. I'm not rubbing that all over my body. And I threw out soaps and I threw out hand washes. We even threw out a toilet brush. Now, in fairness, I don't know why a toilet brush exists. Just think about what a toilet brush is used for. And you just let it sit there for years. Never wash it. Never clean it. Oh yeah, you lift it up once and you put a little bit of bleach inside the little carton and then you close it. That's not okay. There has to be a better way than owning a shitty brush that you just let sit there for ages. And we didn't have a window in our bathroom. But throughout everything, left behind bacteria wipes, left behind toilet rolls. So out of all the things that threw out, face wash, hand wash, toilet rolls, wipes. The only thing that you can walk out and buy today in the world is a toilet brush. And as I've already said, it shouldn't exist. The rest of them we cannot buy, and I just threw them out or left them to my old housemates. If I miss next week, the virus got me and I've only got myself to blame. Really leave a good review for this one, because this could be the last one. God, Dwayne was so nice. We liked when he rambled about God knows what at the top of the podcast. Just wishing that the podcast would start. At least on the other podcast, when there's a little ramble at the top, we know to skip to 8 minutes in or 9 minutes in. Maybe we should just start with the podcast. Go on, I'll let you go. Here we are. Yeah, you want some podcast? You want some podcast? Well, here's some podcast. Here is my first gig with Kerry Pritchard McLean.
Yeah, it's mad. It was really lovely. Yeah, it was just such a nice thing I didn't expect at all. And it's just like, I guess, when I first got nominated, it was like amazing. I got nominated for Compare, I think, like 3 years ago. And it was such a like big self-esteem boost, because like, I think most people who do this who aren't absolutely crazy, and even the ones that are, have big imposter syndrome. So I know I wasn't like the best compare, but the fact that people thought to put me on a list was a really nice thing.
Sure.
Because I was like a baby. I was still I felt like quite new. And then, yeah, I just very, like people, I think people were a bit mean about me being nominated. And I was just really embarrassed then. I felt like, oh, it's what I think. I don't deserve to be on here. And then winning it, I didn't realize until I won them. They're like, oh, this actually means quite a lot because it's voted for by a mixture of comedians and like the public. And I hadn't really like, I didn't really plug it. I forgot to put it in my mail out. Like, I think I put that 4 hours before it ended. I whacked it on my Facebook page. I didn't really throw anything behind it. So it was like, oh, people have gone through a list and they think that I'm the best on it. And that's such a nice feeling.
Sure, yeah.
Whether I agree, I wouldn't have been my pick for either of them. But it's nice that other people think that I'm good at what I do.
Well, to get both, I think, is very interesting because I notice and trying to juggle both being an act and a compare and trying to, you know, it's like if you're in one lane for too long, you kind of lose track of the other.
Totally, totally. So
how do you balance going from one to the other and keeping it strong?
Well, I've made a conscious effort. Like, you got to look at, you know, those who forget the past are condemned to repeat it. So I always look at like acts I really like and that they're brilliant, but they got put in the compare box. So I turn down a lot of work. I tend to only compare my own gigs and gigs for people I like, sure, or gigs for people who won't let me in unless they're comparing. And that's it then. And I kind of just say to the people I know, I'm like, oh, is it all right if I do sets? Because it's not like my sets are shit. I was good at that, but I knew I needed to focus on that. Because you also want to get to the point where you're a headliner. And if you're only working on hosting, you're not working on being a headliner. So, I've been really kind that all those clubs who supported me have been good enough to put me on doing sets. And yeah, I've worked hard on that side of it as well. But I love doing both. But the problem is with comparing, right? If I'm working for a club that I think's difficult or not well run or a tricky time of year like Christmas, I'll always compare over sets because like I think there's almost no situation you can throw at me as a compare I won't be able to deal with.
Sure,
but in sets it's a bit different because like for instance if the compare's shit and hasn't set the room up and then I've got to try and deal with it in my set, that's hard.
Yeah,
it's difficult. Whereas like with comparing, I'm like, no, I'm the captain of the ship. I can deal with sort of anything.
There's free reign as well.
And like set the tone of how you want the night to be. So if it's a trickier gig, I'll just compare. But I try and do. I prefer doing sets because if I compare too much, I'm not very good at it. Because you know when you're chatting to people, like sometimes I'm just like, I don't give a shit what you do for a living in my head because I've compared too much. I lose the love for it. Whereas if I the more infrequently I compare, the better I am at it.
There's only so many times you can hear about people working in marketing.
Exactly. Yeah. Like, yeah, I don't give a shit about IT. Sorry. But yeah, so I'm sparkier if I'm not gigging as much as a compare. Whereas sets, I guess it only gets tighter and tighter. Sometimes I'll realize that like, fuck, I haven't done a set or I haven't compared in like 9 gigs or whatever, which has probably been, you know, maybe just getting on for 2 weeks or something. And you're like, oh shit, have I forgotten how to do this? So you've got to be careful to mix it up during the week as well. Yeah. But yeah, I think I'm all right now, striking a balance.
Would you approach them differently, do you think? Like, would there be two versions of you going on stage or?
No, the good thing is it's starting to, comparing more has given me the confidence to be more myself on stage. Because like I found I was more successful at comparing in a shorter time than sets. I was like, oh, but I'm more me when I'm comparing, so I should just be more me in my sets. And like doing shows makes you kind of more you and find your voice on stage. So yeah, I would approach them differently. And because I just think when you're doing a set, you're at the mercy of more things. You know, like it's mainly other peripheral stuff. Like, whereas like you can totally set the tone or reset the night. But you know, like if the mic is off when you get to it as a compare, that's fine. You could acknowledge it in your thing. But if you get to the stand and you're doing a set and the leads wrap around the microphone, like that's the first few seconds of you where they've lost confidence and like you've got to try and win them back. It's more difficult. But with comparing, you've got, you know, you can use different gears and get to the right point. So yeah, I just think it's easier to maneuver and deal with, like roll with the punches basically when you're comparing. Definitely. And it's not like I have a strict script, like I'm quite fluid in my sets anyway, but I still just think it's a bit more, because also the pressure's off a little bit. Like when you're doing sets, you need to get them straight away. Whereas you're comparing, you can kind of, you don't need to, like you can, but you don't need to come on and be like, huge laughter straight away. Your main job is to admin, to set up the night so they know what they want and you can like ease into the funnies a bit. Whereas the sets, you need to be like bam, 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 bam. Especially like, I mean, less so now, maybe things are getting a bit more progressive, but especially as a girl and like a slightly younger girl, like wandering on, you know, you got to fucking get in there. Like, and you can't always do that if it's something, you know, maybe the compo's done a shit job or something's happened as the compo's brought you on that you then have to deal with, you know, whereas if you're comparing, it's just a bit easier to deal with this stuff, I think.
Well, let's go back and discuss your first gig now. Do you remember your first memory of comedy?
Ooh, yeah, I think, well, yeah, it was, we would get really excited over Christmas because mum would get a new video of Billy Connolly and we'd all sit around and watch it. And I remember just like everyone howling laughing, and I remember looking at everyone laughing and crying laughing and being like, this is amazing, and just like not getting half of it, but like being like, oh wow, look what this is doing to people. I remember being kind of excited by that. But yeah, I think that's the first thing I remember being really engaged by comedy wise
it's a popular answer, the Billy Connolly tapes.
Yeah, because I mean, he's a fucking amazing, he's incredible, like he's so brilliant. And like, yeah, it's just
20 years ago, like that was it, like he was everywhere.
Yeah, you know? And it's like not even, you know, because people like intellectually distance themselves from like other big acts like Peter Kay and Michael McIntyre, and they're like, you know, a bit pissy about it if they've got a degree. But like, I think Billy Connolly kind of transcends all that bullshit and was just the kind of one big thing, other than I guess Lee Evans, although he's a bit before Lee Evans, obviously. But like, yeah, I remember Billy Connolly just like tears of laughter from everyone, and it just being like a spectacle in itself, watching people watch him.
What about live comedy? What was the first live comedy you see?
I know what it was. I went to see, how lucky is this? So when I went to University of Liverpool, which is when I went to uni first time round, they had like a comedy club on campus. And what they did is We Are Clang were on. So Greg Davis emceed, Steve Hall opened, Marek Larwood middled, and then the sketch group We Are Clang, which is obviously all three of them, closed. Right. And it was just like, I didn't realise, but I was like, live comedy is amazing. But I was being fucking insanely spoiled, of course I was. But yeah, it was a great gig. It was like a really electric, and I remember being really thrilled by the idea of stand-up and like what they were doing. But I still at that point hadn't put it in my head that it would be something I'd do.
What did it take to flick that switch?
I mean, this is going to be a really wanky answer, but I saw, because when I went to Liverpool, I was doing like a normal degree. I was doing a BSc in psychology, and then I dropped out because I was like, I spent all my time doing performance stuff and I'm getting this degree to fall back on, and I don't want to do it, and it's just slowing me down by 3 years. So I was like, I'm just going to go and fucking do performance stuff. So I went and did that. And in my first year there, I was doing like contemporary theatre practice, which is like live art and like really, really sort of like cutting edge modern stuff. And we went to this National Review of Live Art in Glasgow. So it's all fucking weird shit there. And, you know, like these world famous performance artists doing fucking weird stuff. Nearly everyone's naked. And we went to this one person called Marcia Farquhar. And she came out, she had like tights on and a bra, knickers and a clothes rack and all these like different clothes hanging on it. And she put the item of clothing on and she taught you through the story of that bit of clothing. And it was packed out in that room and she was so fucking funny. And it was all just stories about, it was a whole show, but like stories about this stuff and like really personal, really charming, sometimes sad, sometimes just like so funny. It's so hilarious, so quick, so charming. And I remember everyone saying afterwards, oh my God, she's like a stand-up. She's so funny. She's like a stand-up. And before that, my idea of a stand-up was a man on stage talking about, you know, just things like kind of expected them to talk about. So it just didn't occur to me that a woman could be like telling this story. I remember she had once a mad fucking tie-dye jacket with kangaroos on, her brother who went insane and lives on a commune in Australia sent to her. She started telling the story of that and it was so fucking funny. And I was like, oh, it can be that. It could be, well, for a start, a woman and talking about really niche, unique experiences in her own voice, in her own way, and people can love it. And that's, I was like, oh, okay, stand up. That's what I want to be then.
What made you think that it wasn't possible, first and foremost, for a woman to do it?
I guess it's because, like, you can't be what you can't see, and there's fewer women, certainly. Sure. Like, we weren't really a Victoria Woodhouse or Joe Brandhouse or Joan Rivers, so I just didn't really see. And also, like, Victoria Wood, I'm like, oh, she's piano, and she does, you know, things like that. So, like, oh, that's not stand-up. And I don't think I was even aware of Joan Rivers and Joe Brand. Yeah, I wasn't aware of when I was growing up either. So I just hadn't seen anything like that. And like at that comedy club I used to go to in university in Liverpool, the only comic I'd seen die there, the first time I saw someone die, was a chick. So I think I was probably internalized all sorts of misogyny about women not being funny, even though I knew I was kind of like people, making people laugh at like sketches and stuff like that. I think I was like, oh yeah, that's just what happens when women try and do that. Which is not the case, obviously.
Thankfully, yes.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
How did the first gig come about? Was it in college, in that comedy club?
Not in that one, but I went back and played that one recently, and it was such a big moment for me.
Nice.
Being like, it was such a great gig. And I was like, oh, this is the first place I ever saw stand-up. And it was like now I'm on this stage. It felt great. But my first gig, I guess I've kind of got two. So I did a comedy course, first of all. And you do like a little gig at the end of it.
Sure, yeah. Like a graduation.
Yeah, exactly. To no fucker. So that was my first gig. I don't really remember. Excuse me, I'm going to yawn. Sorry, I'm boring myself. I don't really remember much about it other than like, knowing that this is not what a gig feels like, of knowing it was like a sanitized version of a gig. And then I think my first proper gig was there were two courses, right? So a Saturday and a Sunday, and I was on the Sunday one. And they said at the end of it, after we did our showcase thing, why don't we all book in to do King Gong, which is the Comedy Store's gong show, where you got to get to 5 minutes and there's like three people in the audience with cards, and if they put them up in the air, you get kicked off the stage, right? And it's hard, and it's like unlike the Frog and Bucket in Manchester, which is the other club in Manchester, which is like, let them find their feet for a little bit, they're like, get them off, because they have like 30
grace, isn't it?
Whereas like, so that's the Frog's vibe, is like, let's see what they've got. If they're a bit of a weirdo, they might lead a bit longer, but they'll be so much more exciting. Whereas the King Gong is like, if they're shit, kick them off as quickly as you can. And
I got a card before I reached the stage.
Yeah, of course, exactly.
The next act is Irish.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I've seen that with ginger people who've driven like 4 hours. Yeah, it's mad. It's brutal. But that's that selling point, and that's what they want. And, you know, there's 30 acts, so I get why they rattle through it. So I remember that was my first gig.
Wow.
And I think I was one of the first on. And, I went on stage, and I just had the, like, arrogance of thinking I was good, which fooled the audience. Yeah, you totally need that. Yeah. And then I was sort of getting, I was doing okay. And then the compere, Mick Ferry, sort of interrupted me because I said something about going to private school. And because I had this shtick about being, don't worry, I'm ashamed of it. And he said, I've always wondered with girls' private schools, with boys, they wank on a biscuit. Yeah, the biscuit game. And he says, what's it going, girls' schools? And I said something about a pink wafer or something like that. But like bantering with him definitely bought me more time in the audience eyes because I could do it.
Sure, yeah.
And like they were like, oh, okay, what she got now? And I wasn't great. I wasn't ripping the gig by any stretch. But like, yeah, there was 28 acts on that night and 4 people got to clap off and I was one of them. So it was, I think there were 3 people from our course and one other person who sort of fluked it by looking a bit like Jesus. But I remember just being like, that was probably unhelpful because I was like, yeah, I'm great. Like, you know, do you know what I mean? I was like, yeah, of course I got to 5 minutes.
Looking
like,
back now though, first gig, King Gong, 5 minutes. What do you make of it now, looking back?
I was not good enough to last. I would have kicked me off. I just didn't have the goods. But, I mean, I think I'm really lucky because if I'd have fucking tanked, I probably am too. I wouldn't have been. I wouldn't have the self. No, I'm too arrogant. I would have been like, yeah, fuck that. I'm not doing that again. It's bullshit. Because I remember I've done this the Gong show twice there. So I went back and I did it on like a bank holiday. And I remember someone heckled and I slammed them. And it was like a stag do on the left-hand side of the room. And there was so many of them. And they just were like, boo. They just couldn't deal with it. So they were like, get rocket chanting. And it was so loud. I had to like turn my back on that side of the room and like shout into the mic and just do the gig to the other 2/3 of the room. And I remember I got to the 5 again and I left it. I don't think I even stayed for the clap off. I remember phoning my boyfriend at the time and I was like, I just got to the 5 and I was like, I don't think I want to do that again because that's not any of the reasons why I do. God, I had to fight to get like the bare minimum of respect. And I'm not saying it's the club at all because I've played it since, it's great. But like, oh, that's not why I do this. This is not
sure,
like...
It's not a normal gig at all. Like.
No, of course not. And this is why like, when like, because I do some, I used to teach in my old uni, I used to teach stand-up module and have taught in various other places when they're like, either like, oh, I got a minute at King Gong or they're like, yeah, I got the 5. I'm like, don't take it seriously either way. Like winning that loads of times is not the sign of a great comic and getting kicked off quickly isn't the sign of a bad comic. Like it's just a gig you do. And when you think you've learned everything from doing that gig, you don't do it again. Like, you know, it's great if it gives you progression with the store, but it's the hardest club to get into. So you're going to have to, they're not going to book you for 20 minutes off smashing a 5. Sure. Like, you know, you've got to just earn, keep and do your time. There's no shortcuts. But yeah, that was my first proper gig, which I guess is a bit of a baptism of fire. And I think I'm really lucky that I got away with it.
I've seen a lot of people do that as their first gig and shake my head and, you know, a bit amazed, but, you know, kind of look, fair play to you. You know,
yeah. All me and my mates used to, because I remember going and watching it, my now boyfriend, I saw him do it at the time and I remember thinking he was really funny, and this years and years and years ago. And I don't think he lasted. But I remember it was just a thing that we all did when we were starting off doing stand-up in Manchester. Are you going to go down to King Gong? And some people just go and do it every month and, you know, get that little bit closer, get 40 seconds more or whatever. And it's, you know, part of their training ground. Because also you are performing to like 400 people.
Sure, yeah.
And when you start out, like a lot of the gigs are tiny and shit. And sometimes it's just other comedians and, you know, someone who's just like nursing a pint and reading a paper. So when you'd be like, oh, I can perform to 400 people who've paid in, and like, because those rooms, like I remember Beat the Frog doing, when I first Beat the Frog, like, I think that was my third gig was Beat the Frog, and I Beat the Frog then. And that was weird because I got introduced as a man. And I was like dressed out for, ready to go for a night out, as in like some tiny sequin little dress, some little shiny tuxedo jacket, huge heels, and Jason Cook was emceeing and he hadn't seen me, so I think he just thought it was an Asian guy, like, because Kiri sometimes people think it is. So he was like, oh, this next guy, give him lots of love. So then I walk up and everyone's like, oh, I see someone is transitioning, because I like so overdressed as well, so I feasibly looked like a drag queen, like, so that was weird and like bless you. Thank weird you. And like eggy, but again, I think that gave me a bit of an edge to get through. So I was just really lucky that I didn't have the tough gigs as early, because I wouldn't have been able to take the knocks. I know what I'm like, too arrogant.
I liked that you say you did a couple of gong shows and you didn't have the tough ones.
Yeah.
To a lot of people, they'd look tough. Or scary anyway. How did you go about writing? Was it, so you went through the course?
Yeah. So I did a course which like was good for me, because I just didn't know what, I think it's a dark art sometimes, stand up, you don't know where to start. And whereas that was like, oh, you should go to this place for a gig, and you know, this is how you get your set. And I think it just helps you almost leapfrog those first really shit 4 gigs, because you know how to start strong, finish, you know, like, you know the structure of how to put it together. I mean, you could probably learn off YouTube or listen to loads of podcasts and it would tell you the same, but excuse me. We come in every week with like new stuff, and that is invaluable. And that's something that, like, I used to, there was a gang of us that started doing comedy at the same time. We're all still mates now. We've got a WhatsApp group, like an online green room. And we used to do a thing at my house called Sunday Club, where everyone would come over and I'd cook everyone a roast and we'd just go over our new stuff. And it was a way of being like, make sure you're always turning out and people chipping in ideas. And like, I've always emceed new material or like regular gigs all the time, because you've got to have new stuff, you've got to be writing. So yeah, I think the more stuff you turn over, the better you are, which is why writing a new show every year is great, because you've got to find an hour of new stuff.
I'm just amazed that you all got together for a roast. That's
yeah. Oh, not like a comedy roast, like a delicious roast to eat.
Oh no, yeah, I'm picturing that.
All right.
That's outdoing anything I've done. So yeah, so you obviously, you had those friends and stuff. Did you tell other friends and family that you'd started this out at the beginning, or did you wait a while?
What, stand up? No, I don't think I, I think it's sort, I saw, other than my mate Faith, who I, she did a little bit of it. She did a course in her uni and I tried to be like, come and do this with me, come do Beat the Frog. And she was jibbed out. And I think I just sort of kept it to myself, really. I think I was probably a bit arrogant at the beginning. I was like, yeah, I think I'm a comedian now. And like, I'd hate someone who did that now. I think I did 3 gigs and then I didn't gig for like a year. So I think I did King Gong, like Laughing Cows, which is a female comedy night in Manchester, which is like the, no, I did Laughing Calves, which is for really, really new acts. And then I did Beat the Frog there. And then I think I didn't do anything because I had to go to work for my ex-boyfriend. I was working to pay our rent because he'd just gone to uni and they didn't pay him properly, blah, blah, blah. So I couldn't really gig. And then at the start of 2010, I was like, no, this is what I want to do. And I just quit my job and was like, I just have to find something that fits in with it, because I was at the Trafford Centre and it's really long days. You couldn't gig, you know, like, because the shifts wouldn't fit in with anything. And I was like, I'm just going to fucking throw everything at this.
3 gigs in, a year off, and you just went.
Yeah, but I wasn't like, I'm now a comedian. I was like, I know I.
You gave up everything else to make this the focus.
Yeah, totally. Wow. Yeah. And I was like, right, I want to get, I've always been about targets. So I'm like, okay, I want to get 50 gigs in my first year, because that means I'm gigging once a week. And by the end of the first year, I'd done 100 gigs. So, and then it was always like, okay, next year I want to do this many. And I used to have a thing when I went full time. I had like a paper diary and I would have to do, there'd be a tally in the corner each week. And that was how many gigs I'd got. Because I knew if I had 4, that meant I was gigging 4 times a week. So I needed to get 4 gigs in the diary. And you have to keep 50 gigs in the diary at any one time. So I've always been like quite, you know, like to make it more structured and achievable and feel like I'm moving forward. Because what can be hard about stand-up is like, you never know where you are and how you're doing thing. You know, like, you're like, am I feel like I'm getting better? Am I? So if you have a goal, like, so silly things like, I want my own music. I want my own walk-on music at the Frog. Like, I know I'll have, that's a thing for me in my head. And then I was like, so I got that next year. And every year I have like, so I remember being like, I want to get nominated for a Chortle Award for Best Compere. And I had it in my head, and that next year I got it. And it's just like, it was a little thing for me, is like, I think I'm, you know, like, it's about pushing yourself.
Sure, yeah.
Because it's, you know, you can't do, like, there's so much you can't control. Like, am I on telly? Like, does so-and-so think I'm good? You know, like that. Whereas if you can go, I want to get in doing 20s at the Glee, then you just make that your focus. Because I remember when I got, like, I was really lucky. I did a 10 spot with a Glee in Cardiff, which is Welsh. And it was, I remember it being on Valentine's Day, because I had to stay in this fucking horrible hotel because all the good hotels are gone. And it was definitely, someone filmed me. It was so gross in there. and I had a great gig. And then like the next day I was on the train, I looked at my emails and they were like, we want to book you for 20s. And I didn't have a 20. So I was like, oh shit. And it was just before Edinburgh where I was going to do a split half hour. And I was like, that was why I was doing that, to get a 20. So I just called in all the favors I could and was like, can you let me come and do a 20? You don't have to pay me. Or like to the Frog and Bucket, who've always been amazing to me, I was like, will you let me do those? They did a thing where you would get paid to do the middle, to do like a 20. But if they wanted to take a punt on someone who is weird or new, they'd go, come and do, you get half the fee, but you do 15 minutes. And I was like, can I go and do that? And they were like, yeah, because they've always been great to me. And while I was there, I was like, I'm just going to overrun as much as I can. So I knew I did 18 and I did a good job. So I was like, well, it's 10% either way. So I still got 3 weeks to get this 2 minutes up to, you know, and it was just all about that focus. And yeah, it was nice and everything went well. But I just, it's so hard sometimes to not watch what other people are doing as well. But if you're hitting your own little goals all the time, doesn't matter whatever the fuck anyone else is doing.
Yeah, I like that idea. You set your own goals.
Yeah, got to run your own race because you will go mad. Even now, like I'm so happy how everything's going for me. Like I love my career. Like I love my work. I love the people I get to work with. Couldn't be happier. But every now and then I'll see someone or get something and I'll be like, why have they got that? And I'm like, well, because that's what's right for them. But like you still have like 6 hours of being like, oh, you know, moaning in your head. And sure, I'm like, this isn't making you a better comedian. So get out of your brain.
That King Gong gig, the first gig, or else if you want to go for the graduation gig, do you remember what your opening joke was?
Yes, I do. It's awful. I think I would... It would always be about... It would usually happen beforehand, but it was a ginger joke where I said, I think ginger girls are really attractive. I've got loads of respect for anyone who could shave their pubic hair to look like a fish finger, was my opening joke, which is awful. And I used to say, all I've got is a bourbon, and that's just not as good after a hangover, which doesn't even really make sense. But like, it was a ginger joke about pubes. And yeah, obviously it was not my time to shine, but it got a laugh and let me do the rest of it. And then I had some really sort of like, some this stuff about private school, and I had some really dark stuff in there because I think dark, like, it was weird. Like, my sense of humor is naturally very dark, and I moved away from that because audiences did not want to hear that from a 23-year-old girl who's quite high status. And my accent was different then. I hadn't lived in Manchester as long. It was kind of, I guess I was more well spoken. So they're like, who's this posh little know it all cunt telling us about the world and being quite dark with it and not very charming? So like, you know, your style evolves, and now a bit more comfortable, I guess it's gone back a bit and it's a bit darker, which is my natural sensibility, I think.
When you had that year off and you made the decision to quit your job and give it a go, what was it that made you give us a full shot? Was there any particular moment? Or
I just knew as soon as I did those three gigs, I was like, yeah, this is what I should be doing. But circumstance, like, I got to pay the bills, and like I had to pay the bills for both of us. So like there was no choice. I just had to go out and work this job I hated. And actually, I had a really great manager at the shop who's really brilliant. We're still sort of in contact. Hi, John. And he used to come over when I'd be on the door, like going, doing great. So he'd be like, hi, you okay there? I'd like, oh, nice day shopping. You know, that bullshit. So I'd be stood there at this job I fucking hate. I hated it, right? But he was dead sound. He's a really good boss. He used to come over and he'd talk about Stuart Lee all the time. And he was a big comedy nerd. So we'd just talk about comedy. And just every time I had that conversation, I was like, what am I doing here? Like, I like talking about the thing I love in a place I hate. So I just knew, sometimes I have to do it where I'm like, I have to make it hard for myself to get to the thing I want to do. So like, I've done that a few times where I just walk away from something where I'm like, nah, this is like, so that's what I did. I was like, handed my notice in and just went and did had a little other job. I've always worked a million jobs. So what happened is January 2010, handed my notice in, had to work till February. And then I was doing another job as well as a mad scientist, it's called, where you dress up in a lab coat and you have I'm Chemical Kiri, and you go and give like fun science lessons to kids. So I was doing that, so I knew I had a bit of money from that. But I did not have enough to sort of like be getting by. And then a sort of job came up in a comedy club in about March at the Frog and Bucket. It was just like a Saturday girl, basically just answering the phone, fucking however, not much money, half I'd say half the money I was on in the other job. But I was like, oh, well, I want to be in comedy. So I applied for this job and I got it. And that was a huge thing, seeing how comedy club worked. There was an agency that operated from out of it. So I saw they book the club. I saw how people book things. I saw how people deal with clients. I saw how agents work, or some agents work. And yeah, it was a real big like eye opener. And I also got to go down and watch comedy every night. And like I had a little a job in a pub as well, which was like a theatre pub. I deliberately worked there because they had shows on all the time. So I just like threw myself into everything and then was gigging as much as I could. And yeah, it was just like, not for everyone. Some people are like, I was lucky I didn't have kids. I didn't have a mortgage at the time. You know, you can make those rash decisions. But sometimes that's the only way I can force myself to apply myself, is to make things tricky.
Well, fair page. Yeah, I don't think many people would take that gamble on themselves. So,
but when you're a fucking idiot at 23 and you're like arrogant, you think it's fine.
Let's go back right before you're called up, first time on stage. You're there waiting for the MC's just gone up.
Yeah.
You know you're next. If you go back and sit down next to yourself, last information, what advice would you give to yourself right before you do your first show?
Oh, I mean, now I'd want to say you're not as funny as you think, but that wouldn't help me have a better gig.
A butterfly effect then.
Yeah. I don't know. I think, do you know what? I was always, I didn't have the microphone at the stand for the first maybe like 8 months of gigging. I would stand with it behind and just talk, which is quite standoffish, and it was deliberately standoffish. And then one day I did a gig where the fucking mic stand wouldn't work, so I took the mic out because it was just necessity. And I was like, as soon as I did it, I was like, oh, this. Because I'm quite like, you know, like I'm a bit better when I'm a bit physical. Mm. And, you know, I'm a lot warmer when I'm not stood behind the mic. And I guess I would go take the mic out of the stand. I think that was because being sort of like high status, little bit posh, dark jokes, stood behind a microphone, hands on my hips, telling you about the world, is like very strong statement. And it could have been, everything would have been a little bit warmer if I just went to them, even physically, a bit more. And so I think I would have gone, just take the mic out of the stand, which is such a basic thing. But like, I can see now that it probably would have helped things.
That was your first gig?
Yeah, great.
Thank you very much for that.
Oh, you're welcome, mate.
There we have it now, guys. Thank you so much for joining me today. Thank you to Kiri Pritchard-McLean for being such a fantastic guest. If you've had fun, you know what to do. Go on over, leave a review on iTunes, because I think that's like the best way to get people to listen to it. Didn't realize that. Going to start pushing it. Might offer you some incentives next week. Leave a review and I'll buy you a Kit Kat. I never sent that person a chocolate. I think one person answered their favorite chocolate with a whisper, which I think they meant whisper. But sure, look, maybe I'll do something. Yeah, little incentives. If you've enjoyed listening to me and you'd like to hear more, then you can follow me home. I'm just kidding, guys. Now follow me at Dwayne Dugan on social media, Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Follow the podcast at My First Gig to find out who next week's guest is. The series finale. That's it. 10 episodes in season one. Take a little break. Come back in a few weeks with series two. Okay, guys. Thank you. See you again. Goodbye. Thanks.
It's the My First Gig podcast. Whoa.